speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free all minds. These are weapons of mass
dissent. These are weapons of mass dissent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Tuesday, August 7th, 2007, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar.
It just makes me stop and think. Silence is not an option.
Is God great? That's the topic of a recent debate between Christopher Hitchens and Chris Hedges on religion. We'll play the entire exciting exchange on today's show.
Sorry if my eyes drop when the fellow meadows out, but I can't help myself, why should I?
This is Uprising. Good morning and welcome to Uprising. We spend the hour today hearing the full-length debate between Christopher Hitchens and Chris Hedges on religion that was recently recorded in Berkeley, California, and briefly featured on KPFK's last fund drive. Christopher Hitchens is a British-American author, journalist, and literary critic. Currently living in Washington, D.C., he has been a columnist at Vanity Fair, The Atlantic, The Nation, Slate, and Free Inquiry. After being considered a leftist for many years, Hitchens came out in support of the U.S. wars in the former Yugoslavia and Iraq. He admitted in 2004 that he was, quote, on the same side as the neoconservatives when it came to contemporary foreign policy issues. Christopher Hitchens is also an avowed atheist, and his latest book is called God is Not Great, How Religion Poisons Everything. Chris Hedges is a journalist and author and a senior fellow at the Nation Institute. He spent nearly two decades as a foreign correspondent in Central America, the Middle East, Africa, and the Balkans. He has reported from more than 50 countries for publications like the New York Times. He is the son of a Presbyterian minister and has a Master of Divinity from Harvard Divinity School. Hedges' latest book is entitled American Fascists, The Christian Right and the War on America. The following debate between Hitchens and Hedges focuses on religion and was entitled Is God Great? It was recorded by KPFA Pacifica in Berkeley on May 24, 2007, and today for the first time we present the entire exchange between these two authors. We'll start by hearing Christopher Hitchens.
I thought of beginning at the end of where I would normally have begun, if that isn't paradoxical, and to reply to a question or observation that I get almost everywhere I go, which is, well, your book is right about saying that the holy texts are full of evil, hatred, bigotry, superstition, misleading ideas, all the rest of it. But why not think about all the people who are godly and faithful and spiritual and who, as it were, don't buy any of this? Well, I could not have written a book that was individually addressed to every person who cherry-picks religion or who decides that it's up to them to take it a la carte. I give you the example of a Baptist with whom I debated in North Carolina last week. I got him this close. I said, you're a Calvinist, right? He said, yeah, I certainly am. I said, well, do you think in that case that either I or anyone else in this room is going to eternal punishment for what they think? And he didn't like the question. I think for two reasons. One, as you know, people in the South are very wedded to their tradition of hospitality. It isn't considered polite in Dixie terms to have a guest to the Unitarian Church hall and tell him that he's going to be tortured with red-hot pincers for eternity. But I didn't think that was the whole story. I thought that he didn't quite want to say it either. And in fact, I thought he probably didn't really, when he examined his conscience, which a faculty with which I was willing to credit him, didn't really believe it. But everywhere I go, they say, oh, but you say that Calvin was bad, but lots of Baptists are good. Now, let's make up our minds about this, I think. Let's not just feel. Let's not just emote. Let us think and let us examine the text, because these are the only things that we really have that we can rely upon. Either this is the word of God or it's not. If it's not, it isn't. Well, either A or not A is a principle of formal and all other kinds of logic. Either it's moral, to move to my main point, or it is not, to believe this. And what I've noticed is that moral people refuse to answer to the precepts of religion when you confront them with it. People of ordinary ethics, and they say ordinary faith, will, when you ask them, well, why is there no hell in the Old Testament? Why is it only with Jesus that eternal punishment, the gentle Nazarene, comes into our lives? Is that what you think or believe? Oh, not really. No, he's a loving Jesus. He's a Jesus of love. Where do you get this from? What's your authority for it? I put myself out and say testable things, which I'm willing to be, will be, hope to be, need to be challenged upon. Why would they do the same? If this were otherwise, I wouldn't have had to write, or felt I needed to write, this book. If it were the case that religion was a la carte and was another form of ethics, just another way of being benign, or of giving money to charity, or of being a philanthropist, then the following observations of mine wouldn't be true. Here are the observations. They're at random. You could add to them yourself. The parties of God in Iraq would not be trying to reduce Iraqi civil society to the level of pre-Afghanistan or post-Somalia, not by killing unbelievers, but by killing other Muslims. And there would have been by now a fatwa, either from the Shia authorities in Qum, or from the Sunni authorities at Al-Azhar University, so the supposed Vatican of the Sunni Muslim world, saying it is not in fact permissible, in fact it's condemned, to blow up each other's mosques, to kill each other's children, to destroy the societies, the families, the lives, the property of other Muslims. No such pronouncement has been made. They can't find it in themselves even to condemn that. People say, should I take the text literally? I say, I don't know. All I know is what the texts actually say. If they can't use these for condemnation, where am I in this? Perhaps it will be found by the rabbinate of some Jewish community, Orthodox, Reform, or Conservative, meet and write to say that it isn't the case that Jewish settlers on the West Bank and Gaza hope by their colonization and theft of other people's land to bring on the Messiah and to make Armageddon that nice little bit nearer. That would bring about the end of days. Why don't we find that the rabbinate can find it in itself to condemn this? Though we hear that the Pope of Rome, the Bishop of Rome, the Mr. Ratzinger, as I always think of him, cannot but think of him, now says, after a great deal of rumination, that all those parents for all those centuries whose children were condemned to limbo because they had not been baptized before they died in childbirth, were in fact not there. It wasn't a real place after all. The hideous cruelty that the believing parents who thought, that's where my child is now, wailing, lost, forgotten, in limbo because I didn't remember the holy water in time before the death. The Pope should be able to say such a callous thing, such an evil thing, a wicked thing, immoral thing, and still be taken seriously as a man able to make pronouncements. I should say, well, we perhaps shouldn't have listened to St. Augustine on this point, but or on many others, such as the Holocaust, the Crusades, the Inquisition, the mass murder in Spanish America, the destruction of the Christian Orthodox non-Catholics of the Balkans and the Ukraine. We're ready to apologize for all that, but only so that we can be infallible all over again. This is not morally serious, and it's not my indictment of them. It is their indictment of themselves. Catholic who says, you don't have to believe what the Pope says, I must inquire of them. To what extent then are you a Catholic, sir? By what authority do you repudiate this obviously evil, man-made doctrine? Well, that's why I begin at the end, because I want to anticipate, since I'm in Berkeley, California, the mush-headed view that there is, after all, a sort of spiritual background to this, an ethical character to it. I would go to invite everyone, who have time, too, because Mr. Hedges is ahead of me, and I'm nearly halfway through my remarks. You've got lots of time to think about it. I want someone to get up tonight and say that they can name a stand made, moral or ethical, a stand of moral courage or political courage made by any religious person that could not have been made by someone who thought that the whole idea of God was ridiculous to begin with. Does anyone not understand the challenge? If by the end of tonight no one can do that, I think my point will have been carried. It is not the case. It simply is not the case that we get our ethics from religion. or can derive it from holy men who believe they are interpreting the will of God and understanding his mind. It simply is not the case. Our morality, our human solidarity, our innate need to help one another, my wish, for example, that I can give a pint of blood to a fellow sufferer without losing one. My blood will be replenished. He will get a pint of blood, or she will, and I don't lose one. The pleasure I get from that is innate. It's part of my mammalian nature, which also makes me rejoice in the death of my enemies and the discomfiture of my foes, and even sometimes the embarrassment of my friends. I can't change this in myself. Neither can you. Pray as you may. You won't be able to change that about yourself. And I say to the Christians while I'm at it, go love your own enemies, by the way. Don't be loving mine. I think the enemies of civilization should be beaten and killed and defeated, and I don't make any apology for it. And I think it's sickly and stupid and suicidal to say that we should love those who hate us and wish to kill us and our children and burn our libraries and destroy our society. I have no patience with this nonsense. Well, that's my preface. I should say it's a great honor to be debating this with Chris Hedges. A couple of times I've nearly got killed in the Middle East by being confused with him. Greater dislike hath no man. The only worst experience I ever had was when I worked for the New Statesman in the old days, the English equivalent of the Nation magazine, the New Statesman, and was asking for an interview with the leader of the Falange Party, a Lebanese fascist Catholic militia, who, when he heard me say, I'm Christopher Hitchens from the New Statesman, babbled into the phone to his genocidal boss, this is important, it's Mr. Christopher from the New Testament. I'd rather be called Hedges than have that, but look, I'll make it quick. Religion comes from the stupid infancy of our species. I won't say race, because that was when we believed in race. We thought the species was differentiated by tribe. That's how stupid we were. And we thought God made covenants with particular tribes. Can anything be more hateful or ridiculous than this? And we didn't know there was a germ theory of disease, because we thought that leprosy and typhoid and bubonic plague were punishments. And we didn't know we lived on a cooling planet with a thin crust, so that volcanoes and earthquakes and tsunamis seemed like a judgment. And we didn't know that we lived on a round planet that went round a rather remote from the rest of the galaxy round star. Didn't know any of this. But they got in first, didn't they, the Christians and the Muslims and the Jews? They were ahead because, as you will know from your experience, intelligent people, given what we have, pattern-seeking minds, will look for explanation even in the absence of evidence. And, as you also know, even smart people will prefer a conspiracy theory to no theory at all if the evidence is missing or is warped. And they got there first, and we have to live with what they told us. They told us that all of this was true, and that in return for regarding ourselves as less than the dust, as people born into original sin, as the Quran says, made from a clot of blood at a whim of God, or as the Christians say, from dust and mud, where even your lowliest rib will suffice to make that even lesser creature a woman, that in return for this masochistic, abject, eternally apologetic, guilt-ridden, fear of sex, hatred of the female genitalia, revulsion from the birth canal except as a one-way street, name me one god, including Buddha, who didn't come from a virgin, and see how unhealthy and unwholesome this masochism is, that in return for this abjection and shame, that we could be consoled by the thought that the whole whirling galaxy and constellation, the magnificence of the known universe, the entire extraordinary Milky Way, was designed with us in mind. The Me Galaxy. The You Constellation. And that God had a plan for us, or for me, or for you. So to compensate for the abjection, the subjection, the humiliation, the groveling, we can make you the biggest egomaniac that you want to be, because God has a plan for you. And he's ready to consider you as the heart of his creation. To fall for this is to degrade, I began with our ethics and our morality, is to degrade them even further. It's to say that a kind act done for a friend or a stranger can only be justifiable, can only be expected of you if you, or could not be expected of you if you did not hope either for a paradisical reward or a hellish punishment. That's why I call it poison. In our most intimate moments of love and solidarity and friendship, it's offering us either a bribe or a threat. It ruins everything that is part of the integrity of our species. And that's innate in it, no matter how much textual revision you subject it to. And it gives a wholly false impression of how the cosmos and the human species came about. You'll alert me, won't you, when I'm trespassing on the time of the woman. And that we don't have to put up with it. But it isn't a coincidence now that, like my metaphor, my preferred analogy for this is Albert Camus, La Peste, the plague. If you remember the novel, at the end of it, the plague is over. The rats have gone back to the sewers. The city of Iran is healthy again. The bacilli have been banished or cured. But everybody in the city knows that the rats and the bacilli are back in the sewers. They'll always be there. They're ready to come out again, and as the novel ends by beautifully saying, to send themselves up to die again in a free city. You are never free from the threat of fundamentalism and religious fascism, because it's always licensed by the original text and by the original misunderstanding, and it will always empower them. 10 years ago, I wouldn't have needed to write this book or wanted to, but today, try me. Try yourself. Turn a page of the newspaper. In Iraq, cradle of Mesopotamian civilization, the parties of God are set on a wreckage of the whole civil society. They would rather beggar and kill everyone than allow it to become a federal democracy, or even to experiment with it. His Holiness the Pope, I have to say something about him, says AIDS may be bad in Africa, but condoms are worse. People in this society say we insist on the stultification of our children by the teaching of pseudoscience. The Iranians have a tooth fairy god called the 12th Imam, a ridiculous, preposterous invention of an apocalyptic kind, and which we wouldn't have to care about except for late-night comedy, except that the same people who believe in this have managed by piracy to acquire an apocalyptic weapon to ram the lesson home. It's said by religious people to me that I must be a seeker, and that if I don't care about God, he cares about me. I turn it back on them. I say, you may think that you live in a country, a society, a period emancipated from theocracy and superstition and barbarism, but you don't. These people are coming after you too, and it's time you woke up to it. Thank you.
Well, I certainly share Christopher's distaste with religious fundamentalism of any type, and I certainly do worry about American democracy and the threat that they, the very real threat they impose to it. But I think he's conflated religion with tribalism, and I think Hitchens sees only one form of religion, the chauvinistic, the bigoted, and the intolerant brand that was embodied in the idiotic pronouncements of figures such as the late Reverend Jerry Falwell or Pat Robertson. He assures us in his book that religion spoke its last intelligible or noble or inspiring words a long time ago. It may speak about the bliss of the next world, he writes, but it wants power in this one. Religion is a product of the bawling and fearful infancy of our species, and all attempts, he assures us, to reconcile faith with science and reason are consigned to failure and ridicule. It's easy, increasingly popular, to attack this childish belief system. But by doing this, we refuse to deal with the nuances and depth of religious faith. Hitchens ignores in his book the great moral and ethical struggles by theologians and religious leaders such as Tillich or Karl Barth, who have attempted to root religion in contemporary society. He never confronts the anguish faced by millions of believers around the world who recognize the impulses we carry within us for evil as well as good. And I think he's unequipped to deal with religious belief, trying vainly to argue against its authenticity. He writes in his book of Dr. Martin Luther King that in no real as opposed to nominal then, sense then, was he a Christian. He disparages the faith of Abraham Lincoln and assures us that Dietrich Bonhoeffer, the Lutheran pastor who was put to death by the Nazis for resistance, was the product of a religious belief that had mutated into an admirable but nebulous humanism. This is a cheap way to avoid the harder task of exploring the wide range of religious experience, of examining the motivations and beliefs of those who come out of a religious tradition and strive to live the moral life. He's determined to demonize religion, and he would have us believe that self-professed religious leaders such as King or Bonhoeffer were not really religious. And in this, he is in fact an ally of the very religious bigots he denounces. The sophistry of this argument mirrors the sophistry of those who misuse the Bible to champion Genesis as the factual account of creation and to persecute homosexuals, Muslims, women, artists, intellectuals, and those they brand with the curse of secular humanist in the name of God. The problem is not religion. The problem is religious orthodoxy and the form it takes in human institutions. Most moral thinkers, from Socrates to Christ to Francis of Assisi, eschewed the written word. Once moral teachings are written down, they become, in the wrong hands, codified and used to enforce conformity, subservience, and repression. Writing freezes speech. George Steiner calls this the decay into writing. Language has turned from a living and fluid form of moral inquiry to a tool of bondage. The moment the writers of the gospel set down the words of Jesus, they began to kill the message. There is no room for prophets within religious institutions, indeed within any institution. For as Tillich knew, all human institutions, including the church, are inherently demonic. Tribal societies persecute and silence prophets. Open societies tolerate them at their fringes. And our prophets today usually do not come from the church, but from our artists, poets, and writers who follow, as I believe Socrates and Jesus did, their inner authority, an authentic religious impulse. Those who deform faith into creeds, who use it as a litmus test for institutional and personal fidelity, root religion in a profane rather than a sacred context. They seek, like all who worship idols, to give the world a unity and coherence it does not possess. They ossify the message, and once ossified, faith withers. There are many theologians, including Tillich, Barth, and Reinhold Niebuhr, who brand the version of religion Hitchens attacks as idolatry, as false and dangerous. And he's right in going after this form of belief. He's wrong in assuming that it is religion. What he fails to acknowledge is the supreme importance of the monotheistic traditions in creating the very concept of the individual. This individualism, the belief that we can exist as distinct beings from the tribe or the crowd, and that we are called on as individuals to make moral decisions that at times defy the clamor of the tribe or the nation, is an important gift of the Abrahamic faiths. This sense of individual responsibility is coupled with the constant injunctions in Islam, Judaism, and Christianity for a deep altruism, and this laid the foundations for our open society. This individualism is the central doctrine and perhaps the most important contribution of monotheism. We are enjoined, after all, to love our neighbor, not our tribe. This empowerment of individual conscience is the starting point of the great ethical systems of our civilization. The prophets, along with Jesus, helped institutionalize dissent and criticism. They initiated the separation of powers. They reminded us that culture and society was not the sole prerogative of the powerful, that freedom, and indeed the religious life, often required us to oppose and defy those in authority. This is a distinctly anti-tribal outlook. Immanuel Kant built his ethics upon this radical individualism. And Kant's injunction to always recognize that human individuals are ends and do not use them as mere means runs in a direct line from the Christian Gospels. Karl Popper rightly pointed out in the first volume of The Open Society and Its Enemies when he writes about this empowerment of the individual versus the crowd, that there is no other thought which has been so powerful in the moral development of man. These religions, in a very real sense, set free the critical powers of humankind. Believers in the Bible and the Quran were called to embrace an abstract, universal deity. This deity could not be captured in pictures, statues, or any concrete, iconographic form. God exists in the Word and through the Word, an unprecedented idea in much of the ancient world that required the highest order of abstract thinking. In the beginning, the Gospel of John reads, "Was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God." This is why the second of the Ten Commandments prohibits Israelites from making concrete images of God. Iconography thus becomes blasphemy, Neil Postman wrote, so that a new kind of God could enter a culture. God, as Hitchens notes correctly, is a human concept. God is the name we give to our belief that life has meaning, one that transcends the world's chaos, randomness, and cruelty. To argue about whether God exists or does not exist is futile. The question is not whether God exists. The question is whether we concern ourselves with or are utterly indifferent to the sanctity and ultimate transcendence of human existence. God is that mysterious force, and you can give it many names, as many religions do, which works upon us and through us to seek and achieve truth, beauty, and goodness. God is perhaps best understood as our ultimate concern, that in which we should place our highest hopes, confidence, and trust. And I think God is better understood as a verb rather than a noun. God is not an asserted existence, but a process accomplishing itself. And God is inescapable. It is the life force that sustains, transforms, and ultimately defines existence. The name of God is laden, thanks to our religious institutions and the numerous tyrants, charlatans, and demagogues these institutions produced, with so much baggage and imagery that it's hard for us to see the intent behind the concept. All societies and cultures have struggled to describe these forces. It is why Freud avoided writing about the phenomena of love. It is by the seriousness of our commitments to compassion, indeed our ability to sacrifice for the other, especially for the outcast and the stranger, our commitment to justice, the core message of the prophets, that we alone can measure the quality of faith. This is the true meaning of faith. As Matthew wrote, "By their fruits shall you know them." Professed faith, what we say we believe, is not faith. It is an expression of loyalty to a community, to our tribe. Faith is what we do. This is real faith. And faith is the sister of justice. Those who silenced Jesus represented all human societies, not the Romans or the Jews. When Jesus attacks the chief priests, scribes, lawyers, Pharisees, Sadducees, and other blind guides, he is attacking forms of oppression as endemic to Christianity as to all religions and all ideologies and all institutions. If civil or religious authority enforces an iron and self-righteous conformity among members of a community, then faith is transformed into ideology. Faith is not in conflict with reason. Faith does not conflict with scientific truth unless faith claims to express a scientific truth. Faith can neither be affirmed nor denied by scientific, historical, or philosophical truth. And here I think Hitchens confuses the irrational, which he sees as an endemic part of faith, with the non-rational. There is a spiritual dimension to human existence and the universe, but this is not irrational. It is non-rational. Faith allows us to transcend what Flaubert said was our mania for conclusions, a mania he described as one of humanity's most useless and sterile drives. The sole reliance on reason, faith in human reason, allows us to ignore the dark Freudian undercurrents that lead to self-worship. And it leads to a dangerous form of idolatry, a form of faith, certainly, but one most of the biblical writers knew led to evil and eventually self-destruction. Hitchens states that the whole record will show, first, that person for person, American free thinkers and agnostics and atheists come out the best. He assures us that someone's secular or free-thinking opinion would cause him or her to denounce injustice. This assertion, coming from an apologist for the war in Iraq, for the crime of aggression committed by the Bush administration in our name, is, to say the least, rich. The danger, which I think Hitchens fails to see, is not Islam or Christianity or any other religion. It is the human heart, the capacity we all have for evil. All human institutions, including religious institutions, with a lust for power, give their utopian visions divine sanction. Whether this comes through the worship of God, destiny, historical inevitability, the master race, a worker's paradise, fraternité, égalité, liberté, or the second coming of Jesus Christ. And religion is often a convenient vehicle for this bloodlust. Religious institutions often sanctify genocide. But this says more about us, about the nature of human institutions and the darkest human yearnings, than it does about religion. His book finally externalizes evil. And when you externalize evil, all tools, including violence and torture, become legitimate. This is an assault on what he defines as the irrational force of religion. But once we begin this assault, it permits us to sanction the abuse and subjugation of others. This is done in the name of another particular version of goodness, the goodness of reason. But this too is a false god, an idol. Once you wage unprovoked wars and embrace torture, you unleash sadists and killers. You consign other human beings to moral oblivion. You become no better than those you oppose. Hitchens does what fundamentalists do. He embraces a self-serving and I think finally simplistic view of religion and the world. And this allows him to create an illusion of a binary world of us and them, of reason versus irrationality, of the forces of light battling the forces of darkness. And once you set up this vision, it becomes possible to view anything that will subdue what is defined as irrational and dangerous as necessary. Necessity, William Pitt wrote, is the plea for every infringement of human freedom. Thank you.
You're listening to a debate between Christopher Hitchens and Chris Hedges on the topic of religion. We just heard Chris Hedges. After this short break and this radical day in history, we'll hear part two of the debate. Stay tuned.
Hi, I'm Bridget from KPFK's membership department. We'd like to remind you, if you haven't already done so, please send in your FunDrive pledge payments. And we'd like to thank you for continuing to support Radio Powered by the People.
This is your radio reporter, Hannah George. On this day, August 7th in 1960, a year and a half after the Cuban Revolution, Castro had begun nationalizing American properties and industries throughout the previous year, completely crushing America's domination over the Cuban economy. These actions infuriated the U.S., who placed a total embargo on the socialist country. After failing to overthrow Castro the next year, the American government continued to penalize Cuba with harsh economic and immigration restrictions. I mean, how dare Cuba want to run its own economy? Preposterous. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never look past.
Welcome back to Uprising. We now turn back to the debate between Christopher Hitchens and Chris Hedges that took place in Berkeley, California earlier this year. KPFA's interim program director, Sasha Lilly, who was moderating the debate, next asked Christopher Hitchens if he believed that secular institutions have the same history of violence as the religious ones.
I don't have the white noise ability to invoke faith as my opponent does, but I will remind you all, ladies and gentlemen, that I offered you a fair bet at the beginning, and I included my opponent, as I now think of him, in the wager. Can you name a moral action committed by somebody in the name of their God or their church that you could not have committed yourself? And I'm still waiting for anyone to get up and say, this could only have been done by faith. And I'm still waiting for him to say so too. I'll make that point. On not your point about the secular, or the secular atrocious, I care about it enough to have developed a whole passage, a whole chapter of my book to it, available, by the way, at fine bookstores everywhere. I am still a materialist. In this form, you can be an atheist and a sadist, or a nihilist, or a fascist, or a communist, but it's not necessitated because you don't invoke supernatural aid for your view. You don't say, I'm doing this because God makes me do so, thus you have to do so too. You take your chances. Put the case, if you like, since it comes up all the time, of Joseph Dugashvili Vissarionovich, the Georgian despot. In Russia in 1917, millions of Russians for hundreds and hundreds of years have been told, without any contradictory evidence, that the head of their state was not just an absolutist despot who owned everyone and everything within the borders of Russia, but that he was also the head of the Russian Orthodox Church. And if a little below the angels, a little above the common human level, that was their model, and that's what they believed. If you're Joseph Stalin, you shouldn't even be in the dictatorship business if you can't exploit a pool of credulity and servility and stupidity that has been left to you like that by your Christian predecessors. You're not, and he'd been a seminarian all his life, remember. He would think this is too easy. I can stage an inquisition, which he did. I can stage a heresy hunt for heretics, which he did. I can offer miracles, which with Lysenko's pseudo-biology promising three a harvest a year, he also did. I can find out who Satan is working with within the borders of our wonderful dominion easily, and I can print it in Pravda. The whole thing is a horrible simulacrum of what had been left to the abandoned, despised, ground-down Russian people by their education in Christianity. Now, if there's to be a level playing field, which I know that my opponents don't wish for, I want to be told how it is that any society that follows the precepts of Lucretius and of Spinoza and of Galileo and of Russell and of Voltaire and Jefferson and Paine and Einstein has ever fallen into the same pit of ignorance, famine, cruelty, stupidity, hysteria, witch hunting that is the special privilege of the faithful. So that's my short answer to your question. Let's try that for an experiment and see who comes out better.
Chris Hedges.
Yeah, I mean, I hate institutional religion as much as Christopher does.
You prefer an individual.
But I think that, you know, and this is something that numerous writers, you know, from Dostoevsky, I mean, even Beckett, I think in some ways is a deeply, probably the most authentically religious writer of the 20th century, in understanding the kind of morally neutral universe in which we live and that need for interconnectedness, you know, that mystery that surrounds us. And all societies and all cultures have struggled to give words to this mystery, this transcendence. That is the religious impulse. Of course, there are many people who have done what I would define as deeply ethical acts that don't come out of a religious tradition. But I think, and again, going back to the Tillich quote, I think, you know, all institutions, as soon as belief systems become institutionalized, they become, in Tillich's words, demonic, that institutions seek their own power and their own self-perpetuation. And I think what we're doing here is confusing the very dark history of religious institutions and that fusion of religious iconography and religious language with the iconography and language of nationalism, a frightening and toxic mix is throughout history, and certainly something that we both saw in the Balkans. From that authentic religious impulse, which is palpable within human society, it's real. It's why science or can study sexual urges and lust, but it fails finally when it tries to study love. It's why even Freud himself gave up and quite publicly said it was something that he couldn't grapple with. And I think that's what we're dealing with. I especially coming out of the church, I have a great deal of anger, and maybe even more anger in some ways than Christopher does, towards the bigots who wrap themselves, in the American flag and clutch the Christian cross. But I think we do have to make a distinction between those impulses that I would describe as religious, essentially non-rational, and religious institutions.
No, I'm sorry.
We'll get back to it. No, we're moving on.
This is very important.
One commonality that all the world's organized religions share, whether it is fundamentalist Judaism, Christianity, Hinduism, Islam, or Buddhism, is the subjugation of women. Why do you think that is?
Well, they're patriarchal structures. If you look at religious institutions, they are designed in such a way to create within the family a power model where the male is dominant, the woman is subservient, and the children are obedient. That power structure is to be recreated within the church, within the community, and ultimately within the nation. So it fits exactly with the kind of power structure that these religious institutions seek to replicate throughout society. And when given a chance, Iran would be a good example. Certainly the kind of Christian nation that people like Benny Hinn or Falwell or any of these people seek to create has as its core the subjugation of women. And the argument they use is that was divinely sanctioned. And that's why they have such a problem with homosexuality, because they need that binary world view, those clearly defined lines. And any kind of nuance or any kind of challenge to that is an assault to their personal power.
Christopher Hitchens?
Well, so clap if you must. You can save your applause for me, who haven't spoken yet. If what Mr. Hedges said was true, any of it, the word scripture would be meaningless because there would be no, as he chooses to call it, codification. In other words, Jesus would not have said he came to fulfill the ancient written prophecies. He would not have made that claim if people had not read them and revered them as if they were above the common ruck of human writing. It's quite absurd for him to say that the writing down of it makes it immoral. He's right to say that the writing down of it allows us to scrutinize it and see that it is not divinely ordained, not revealed, but man-made. Shouldn't it be obvious to everyone in this room that let's not quarrel about how long the human species has been around, fully evolved. Some tens of thousands of years are generally agreed, perhaps longer. That God should have watched this species suffering, dying in childbirth, life expectancy of about 20 years, swept with plague, famine, misery, shame, mystery, dying in Brazil, dying in China, dying in Australia, countries not known to any of the writers of these testaments. Their animals not even known by it. And to have decided only a few thousand years ago, maybe it's time to intervene. Have a son of mine torn to shreds in a remote part of Bronze Age Palestine. Let the Chinese wait a few thousand years to find out that that's what happened. That should make them love each other. It's not to be believed. No serious person can believe it. Okay? Now, one way that you can prove it's not just man-made, but masculine-made, male-made, is the following. It's always, in every case, devoted to the subjugation of women. The Orthodox Jew has to begin the daily prayer. Thank God for not making me a woman or a goy. That's how much they think of women. Somebody has to buy retail, as was once said of the Goyish. Everybody knows what Islam says and mandates for women. Everybody knows also what St. Paul said about women. Everybody knows, even those who, probably there's some here who think maybe I have a Buddhist option here, has to notice that even Buddha is born from a slit in his mother's side. anything but the filth and disgust of having to contemplate the female reproductive system. What could be more obviously man-made than this? And made in a barbaric period, even of the history of the male sex, it's plain as could be. The terror of menstrual blood, for example, the horror of it, the feeling of uncleanliness that attaches to everything female. That's before you start with every other manifestation of sexuality. Filthy, guilt-ridden, masochistic, horrible. Our emancipation from this is the condition of our emancipation under, it seems to me, any terms at all. And anybody who is willing to say, I still haven't had, I see, a challenge to my, or an answer to my challenge, that there's anything ethical about this belief, or that any ethical person couldn't say what any religious person has ever said, must begin with the absolutely obvious fact that half our species is condemned to subjecthood and disgust by the preachings of this Abrahamic, man-made, filthy propaganda. We must get over it. Emancipation, human emancipation, as with slavery, as with racism and creationism and all the other superstitions, human emancipation begins where this nonsense ends, and the time is short for us to find this out.
Well, that gets to the notion that somehow, if you abolish religion, which has been part of every human society since human society has been recorded, these dark impulses are somehow going to vanish. If torturers, killers, sadists, and tyrants don't wrap themselves in the cloak of religion, they'll wrap themselves in the cloak of something else. Fascism, communism, I mean, these are, and I think as you correctly pointed out, bear many similarities to the kinds of ideological forms that we see within repressive religious institutions. The problem is not religion. The problem is the capacity we all have for evil, the capacity we all have for atrocity. And as long as we externalize evil, and that's, of course, what religious fundamentalists do, we can't guard against the ability and the seductiveness that all of us carry within ourselves. Great writers like Primo Levi struggled with this for most of their lives. You know when you're in a war zone that the line between the victim and the victimizer is always razor thin, and people will always find religious, ideological belief systems to justify evil. The problem is not religion. The problem is in the human heart.
Christopher Hitchens, you praise in your book the rationalist legacy of the Dutch Jewish philosopher Spinoza. Yet Spinoza was a pantheist. He believed that the universe and nature are inhabited by some kind of abstract divine force. Do you see any harm in this sort of spirituality without God?
Not really, I don't, because Spinoza, who I suppose you can still call Dutch Jewish, was in fact neither Dutch nor Jewish. He was excommunicated viciously by his synagogue and changed his name to avoid further identification. And his greatest emulator, Albert Einstein, followed him in saying that the whole idea of a personal God or a God who intervened was not just ridiculous but detestable. Such a person is obviously not going to tell me that I can't have a ham sandwich, or not that I particularly wish to, retire to a motel with Mr. Hedges after this is over, as if to make up our differences, as it were, rediscovers what was noted rather sapiently by Epicurus and Democritus well before any Abrahamic tyranny had imposed itself on us. How they knew this, I don't know. I'd love to know how they found it out. But that the world is made of atoms, and that if there are any gods, they're much too smart to involve ourselves in our sordid little quarrels. So as someone who says, I feel spiritual, and I'm okay and you're okay, I find intensely boring. But if they're not going to try and tell me that their views must be taught in my children's school, or that their views must be legislated about stem cells or contraception, or that stultifying crap must not be taught in the schools under the name of intelligent design, I'll agree to avoid them, and they can go off and bore someone else. And though that's not the greatest lesson taught by Spinoza and Einstein, it's still a very important one. But there isn't a Christian or a Jew or a mono, or, an Islam, or a Muslim who can make you that promise. They can't. They will not leave you alone. And turn any page or open any page of any newspaper today, and you'll see that they find the authority for bullying you and lecturing you and trying to intimidate you in their holy texts. And why wouldn't they? Because in those man-made texts, that authority for the punishment of apostasy or infidelity or womanhood or sexuality or free thinking is already there, just like the rats and the bacilli in La Peste, just waiting to be revived by the turn of a page. Please, know an enemy when you see one.
We're not in disagreement on this particular brand of, you know, of religion, for lack of a better word, although I look at the Christian right not as a religious movement anymore, but as a mass political movement, probably the most frightening mass movement in American history. It's easy to beat up on people who embrace a non-reality-based belief system. It's easy. I think it's important to recognize what it is that drives people into the arms of these demagogues. And in that sense, I have a little more compassion than I think Christopher does for them. It's despair. It's economic and personal despair. We live in a country that is rapidly becoming an oligarchy, a corporate state. The top 1% in this country have amassed more wealth than the bottom 90% combined. Writers on democracy all the way back to Plutarch and Thucydides understood that you cannot sustain a democracy in an oligarchic state. We have whole sections now of the United States that resemble the developing world. Only 9% of jobs are in manufacturing jobs, the lowest point since the Industrial Revolution. State and federal assistance programs have been slashed. Communities are boarded up wrecks. And these people have lost hope. They've lost hope not only for themselves, but for their children. There's been a kind of Weimarization of the American working class. There's a pernicious assault on the middle class. Anything that can be put on software can be outsourced, is being outsourced. And when you create those inequities and disparities, you push people into the arms of demagogues who promise them a world of magic and miracles, that Jesus will walk with them and protect them and take care of them and has a divine plan for them. And I detest these people as much as you do. But I don't detest the followers who we as a country have betrayed. And I don't define that as religion. This is a totalitarian movement. Totalitarian movements often cloak themselves in religious garb, and religious institutions have a long and terrible history of willingly embracing these movements. But that for me is not religion, nor does it express a religious impulse.
You've been listening to a debate between Christopher Hitchens and Chris Hedges, recorded earlier this year at King Middle School in Berkeley, California, by KPFA Pacifica Radio. To order a copy of this entire debate, call the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. For Sonali's subversive thought for the day, I'd like to quote Algernon Black, who once said, "Why not let people differ about their answers to the great mysteries of the universe? Let each seek one's own way to the highest, to one's own sense of supreme loyalty in life, one's ideal of life. Let each philosophy, each worldview, bring forth its truth and beauty to a larger perspective that people may grow in vision, stature, and dedication." That's Sonali's subversive thought for the day. You've been listening to Uprising. Gabriel San Roman is our assistant producer. Tamika Zogi is our engineer. You can hear an audio stream of today's program after 10 a.m. on our website, which is linked via kpfk.org. Our email is mail@uprisingradio.org. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kohatkar. Thanks for listening.